Disc 16.
Book 3. The Prophet. No woman, no man, no child ever was deeply intimate with my father. The closest anyone ever came to casual camaraderie with the Padishah Emperor was the relationship offered by Count Hazimir Fenring, a companion from childhood. The measure of Count Fenring's friendship may be seen first in a positive thing. He allayed the Landsrad's suspicions after the Arrakis affair. It cost more than 1 billion solaris in spice bribes, so my mother said, and there were other gifts as well. Slave women, royal honors, and tokens of rank. The second major evidence of the Count's friendship was negative. He refused to kill a man, even though it was within his capabilities and my father commanded it. I will relate this presently. Count Fenring, A Profile, by the Princess Irulan. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen raged down the corridor from his private apartments, flitting through patches of late afternoon sunlight that poured down from high windows. He bobbed and twisted in his suspensors with violent movements. Past the private kitchen he stormed, past the library, past the small reception room, and into the servants' antechamber, where the evening relaxation already had set in. The guard captain, Yakin Nafood, squatted on a divan across the chamber, the stupor of Samuta dullness on his flat face, the eerie wailing of Samuta music around him. His own court sat near to do his bidding. "Nafood!" the baron roared. Men scrambled. Nafood stood, his face composed by the narcotic, but with an overlay of paleness that told of his fear. The Samuta music had stopped. "My lord baron," Nafood said. Only the drug kept the trembling out of his voice. The baron scanned the faces around him, seeing the looks of frantic quiet in them. He returned his attention to Nafood and spoke in a silken tone. "How long have you been my guard, Captain Nafood?" Nafood swallowed.
"Since Arrakis, my lord. Almost 2 years."
"And have you always anticipated dangers to my person?"
"Such has been my only desire, my lord."
"Then where is Fade Rautha?" the baron roared.
Nafood recoiled.
"My lord, you do not consider Fade Rautha a danger to my person?"
Again, the voice was silken.
Nafood wet his lips with his tongue. Some of the Samuta dullness left his eyes. "Fade Rautha's in the slave quarters, my lord."
"With the women again, eh?"
The baron trembled with the effort of suppressing anger. "Sire, it could be he's..."
"Silence!"
The baron advanced another step into the antechamber, noting how the men moved back, clearing a subtle space around Nafood, dissociating themselves from the object of wrath. "Did I not command you to know precisely where the Nebaron was at all times?" the baron asked. He moved a step closer. "Did I not say to you that you were to know precisely what the Nebaron was saying at all times, and to whom?" Another step. "Did I not say to you that you were to tell me whenever he went into the quarters of the slave women?" Nafood swallowed. Perspiration stood out on his forehead. The baron held his voice flat, almost devoid of emphasis. "Did I not say these things to you?" Nafood nodded. "And did I not say to you that you were to check all slave boys sent to me, and that you were to do this yourself?"
Personally? Again, Nafud nodded. Did you, perchance, not see the blemish on the thigh of the one sent me this evening? The Baron asked. Is it possible you... Uncle... The Baron whirled, stared at Fade Rautha standing in the doorway. The presence of his nephew here, now, the look of hurry that the young man could not quite conceal, all revealed much. Fade Rautha had his own spy system focused on the Baron. There is a body in my chambers that I wish removed, the Baron said, and he kept his hand at the projectile weapon beneath his robes, thankful that his shield was the best. Fade Rautha glanced at two guardsmen against the right wall, nodded. The two detached themselves, scurried out the door and down the hall toward the Baron's apartments. Those two, eh? The Baron thought. Ah, this young monster has much to learn yet about conspiracy. I presume you left matters peaceful in the slave quarters, Fade, the Baron said. I've been playing Cheops with the slave master, Fade Rautha said, and he thought, what has gone wrong? The boy we sent to my uncle has obviously been killed. But he was perfect for the job. Even Howitt couldn't have made a better choice. The boy was perfect. Playing pyramid chess, the Baron said. How nice. Did you win? Yes, uncle. And Fade Rautha strove to contain his disquiet. The Baron snapped his fingers. Nafud, you wish to be restored to my good graces. Sire, what have I done? Nafud quavered. That's unimportant now, the Baron said. Fade has beaten the slave master at Cheops. Did you hear that? Yes, sire. I wish you to take three men and go to the slave master, the Baron said. Garot, the slave master. Bring his body to me when you've finished, that I may see it was done properly. We cannot have such inept chess players in our employ. Fade Rautha went pale, took a step forward. But, uncle, I... Later, Fade, the Baron said, and waved a hand. Later. The two guards who had gone to the Baron's quarters for the slave boy's body staggered past the antechamber door with their load sagging between them, arms trailing. The Baron watched until they were out of sight. Nafud stepped up beside the Baron. You wish me to kill the slave master now, my lord? Now, the Baron said, and when you've finished, add those two who just passed to your list. I don't like the way they carried that body. One should do such things neatly. I'll wish to see their carcasses, too. Nafud said, My lord, is it anything that I've... Do as your master has ordered, Fade Rautha said. And he thought... All I can hope for now is to save my own skin. Good, the Baron thought. He yet knows how to cut his losses. And the Baron smiled inwardly at himself, thinking, The lad knows, too, what will please me, and be most apt to stay my wrath from falling on him. He knows I must preserve him. Who else do I have who could take the reins I must leave some day? I have no other as capable. But he must learn, and I must preserve myself while he is learning. Nafud signaled men to assist him, led them out the door. Would you accompany me to my chambers, Fade? The Baron asked. I am yours to command, Fade Rautha said. He bowed, thinking, I'm caught. After you, the Baron said, and he gestured to the door.
Fade Rautha indicated his fear by only the barest hesitation.
Have I failed utterly? He asked himself. Will he slip a poisoned blade into my back? Slowly, through the shield? Does he have an alternative successor?
Let him experience this moment of terror, the Baron thought as he walked along behind his nephew. He will succeed me, but at a time of my choosing. I'll not have him throwing away what I've built.
Fade Rautha tried not to walk too swiftly. He felt the skin crawling on his back as though his body itself wondered when the blow could come. His muscles alternately tensed and relaxed.
Have you heard the latest word from Arrakis? The Baron asked.
No, Uncle.
Fade Rautha forced himself not to look back. He turned down the hall out of the servants' wing.
They've a new prophet or religious leader of some kind among the Fremen, the Baron said.
They call him Muad'Dib.
Very funny, really.
It means the mouse. I've told Rabban to let them have their religion. It'll keep them occupied.
That's very interesting, Uncle, Fade Rautha said. He turned into the private corridor to his uncle's quarters, wondering, why does he talk about religion? Is it some subtle hint to me?
Yes, isn't it? The Baron said.
They came into the Baron's apartments through the reception salon to the bedchamber.
Subtle signs of a struggle greeted them here. A suspenser lamp displaced, a bed cushion on the floor, a soother reel spilled open across a bedstand.
It was a clever plan, the Baron said.
He kept his body shield tuned to maximum, stopped, facing his nephew.
But not clever enough.
Tell me, Fade, why didn't you strike me down yourself? You've had opportunity enough.
Fade Rautha found a suspensor chair, accomplished a mental shrug as he sat down in it without being asked.
I must be bold now, he thought. You taught me that my own hands must remain clean, he said.
Yes, the Baron said. When you face the Emperor, you must be able to say truthfully that you did not do the deed. The witch at the Emperor's elbow will hear your words and know their truth or falsehood.
Yes, I warned you about that.
Why haven't you ever bought a Bene Gesserit, Uncle? Fade Rautha asked.
With a truth-sayer at your side. You know my tastes, the Baron snapped.
Fade Rautha studied his uncle, said, Still, one would be valuable for—
I trust them not, the Baron snarled, and stop trying to change the subject.
Fade Rautha spoke mildly.
As you wish, Uncle.
I remember a time in the arena several years ago, the Baron said. It seemed there that day a slave had been set to kill you.
Is that truly how it was?
It's been so long ago, Uncle.
After all,
No evasions, please, the Baron said, and the tightness of his voice exposed the rein on his anger.
Fade Rautha looked at his uncle, thinking, He knows, else he wouldn't ask.
It was a sham, Uncle. I arranged it to discredit your slave master.
Very clever, the Baron said.
Brave, too.
That slave gladiator almost took you, didn't he?
Yes.
If you had finesse and subtlety to match such courage, you'd be truly formidable.
The Baron shook his head from side to side, and as he had done many times since that terrible day on Arrakis, he found himself regretting the loss of Piter, the Mentaunt. There'd been a man of delicate, devilish subtlety. It hadn't saved him, though. Again, the Baron shook his head. Fate was sometimes inscrutable. Feyd-Rautha glanced around the bedchamber, studying the signs of the struggle, wondering how his uncle had overcome the slave they'd prepared so carefully. "How did I best him?" the Baron asked. "Ah, now, Feyd, let me keep some weapons to preserve me in my old age. It's better we use this time to strike a bargain." Feyd-Rautha stared at him. "A bargain? He means to keep me as his heir for certain, then. Else, why bargain? One bargains with equals, or near equals." "What bargain, uncle?" And Feyd-Rautha felt proud that his voice remained calm and reasonable, betraying none of the elation that filled him. The Baron, too, noted the control. He nodded. "Your good material, Feyd. I don't waste good material. You persist, however, in refusing to learn my true value to you. You are obstinate. You do not see why I should be preserved as someone of the utmost value to you. This," he gestured at the evidence of the struggle in the bedchamber, "this was foolishness. I do not reward foolishness." "Get to the point, you old fool," Feyd-Rautha thought. "You think of me as an old fool," the Baron said. "I must dissuade you of that. You speak of a bargain. Ah, the impatience of youth," the Baron said. "Well, this is the substance of it, then. You will cease these foolish attempts on my life, and I, when you are ready for it, will step aside in your favor. I will retire to an advisory position, leaving you in the seat of power." "Retire, uncle?" "You still think me the fool," the Baron said, "and this but confirms it, eh? You think I'm begging you. Step cautiously, Feyd. This old fool saw through the shielded needle you'd planted in that slave boy's thigh. Right where I'd put my hand on it, eh? The smallest pressure and stick. A poison needle in the old fool's palm. Ah, Feyd." The Baron shook his head, thinking it would have worked, too, if Hawat hadn't warned me. "Well, let the lad believe I saw the plot on my own." "In a way, I did. I was the one who saved Hawat from the wreckage of Arrakis. And this lad needs greater respect for my prowess." Feyd-Rautha remained silent, struggling with himself. Is he being truthful? Does he really mean to retire? Why not? I'm sure to succeed him one day if I move carefully. He can't live forever. Perhaps it was foolish to try hurrying the process. "You speak of a bargain," Feyd-Rautha said. "What pledge do we give to bind it?" "How can we trust each other, eh?" the Baron asked. "Well, Feyd, as for you, I'm setting Thufir Hawat to watch over you. I trust Hawat's Mentaunt capabilities in this. Do you understand me? And as for me, you'll have to take me on faith." But I can't live forever, can I, Fade? And perhaps you should begin to suspect now that there are things I know which you should know. I give you my pledge, and what do you give me? Fade Rath asked. I let you go on living, the Baron said. Again, Fade Rath studied his uncle. He sets Hawat over me. What would he say if I told him Hawat planned the trick with the gladiator that cost him his slave master? He'd likely say I was lying in the attempt to discredit Hawat. No, the good Thufir is a mentat and has anticipated this moment. Well, what do you say? The Baron asked. What can I say? I accept, of course. And Fade Rath thought, Hawat. He plays both ends against the middle. Is that it? Has he moved to my uncle's camp because I didn't counsel with him over the slave boy attempt? You haven't said anything about my setting Hawat to watch you, the Baron said. Fade Rath betrayed anger by a flaring of nostrils. The name of Hawat had been a danger signal in the Harkonnen family for so many years. And now it had a new meaning. Still dangerous. Hawat's a dangerous toy, Fade Rath said. Toy? Don't be stupid. I know what I have in Hawat and how to control it. Hawat has deep emotions, Fade. The man without emotions is the one to fear. But deep emotions. Ah, now those can be bent to your needs. Uncle, I don't understand you. Yes, that's plain enough. Only a flicker of eyelids betrayed the passage of resentment through Fade Rath. And you do not understand Hawat, the Baron said. Nor do you, Fade Rath thought. Who does Hawat blame for his present circumstances? The Baron asked. Me? Certainly. But he was an Atreides tool and bested me for years until the Imperium took a hand. That's how he sees it. His hate for me is a casual thing now. He believes he can best me any time. Believing this, he is bested, for I direct his attention where I want it, against the Imperium. Tensions of a new understanding drew tight lines across Fade Rauther's forehead, thinned his mouth. Against the Emperor? Let my dear nephew try the taste of that, the Baron thought. Let him say to himself, the Emperor Fade Rath Harkonnen. Let him ask himself how much that's worth. Surely it must be worth the life of one old uncle who could make that dream come to pass. Slowly, Fade Rath wet his lips with his tongue. Could it be true what the old fool was saying? There was more here than there seemed to be. And what has Hawat to do with this? Fade Rath asked. He thinks he uses us to wreak his revenge upon the Emperor. And when that's accomplished, he does not think beyond his revenge. Hawat's a man who must serve others and doesn't even know this about himself. I've learned much from Hawat, Fade Rath agreed, and felt the truth of the words as he spoke them. But the more I learn, the more I feel we should dispose of him. And soon. You don't like the idea of his watching you. Hawat watches everybody. And he may put you on a throne. Hawat is subtle. He is dangerous, devious. But I'll not yet withhold the antidote from him. A sword is dangerous too, Fade. We have the scabbard for this one, though. The poison's in him. When we withdraw the antidote, death will sheath him. In a way, it's like the arena, Fade Routh has said. Feints within feints within feints. You watch to see which way the gladiator leans, which way he looks, how he holds his knife. He nodded to himself, seeing that these words pleased his uncle, but thinking, yes, like the arena, and the cutting edge is the mind. Now you see how you need me, the Baron said. I'm yet of use, Fade. A sword to be wielded until he's too blunt for use, Fade Routha thought. Yes, uncle, he said. And now, the Baron said, we will go down to the slave quarters, we two. And I will watch while you, with your own hands, kill all the women in the pleasure wing. Uncle! There will be other women, Fade. But I have said that you do not make a mistake casually with me. Fade Routh's face darkened. Uncle, you will accept your punishment and learn something from it, the Baron said. Fade Routh met the gloating stare in his uncle's eyes. And I must remember this night, he thought. And remembering it, I must remember other nights. You will not refuse, the Baron said. What could you do if I refused, old man? Fade Routh asked himself. But he knew there might be some other punishment. Perhaps a more subtle one. A more brutal lever to bend him. I know you, Fade, the Baron said. You will not refuse. All right, Fade Routh thought. I need you now. I see that. The bargain's made. But I'll not always need you. And someday. Deep in the human unconscious is a pervasive need for a logical universe that makes sense. But the real universe is always one step beyond logic. From The Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. I've sat across from many rulers of great houses, but never seen a more gross and dangerous pig than this one, Thufir Hawat told himself. You may speak plainly with me, Hawat, the Baron rumbled. He leaned back in his suspensor chair, the eyes in their folds of fat boring into Hawat. The old Mentat looked down at the table between him and the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, noting the opulence of its grain. Even this was a factor to consider in assessing the Baron, as were the red walls of this private conference room and the faint, sweet herb scent that hung on the air, masking a deeper musk. You didn't have me send that warning to Rabban as an idle whim, the Baron said. Hawat's leathery old face remained impassive, betraying none of the loathing he felt. I suspect many things, my lord, he said. Yes. Well, I wish to know how Arrakis figures in your suspicions about Seleucus Secundus. It is not enough that you say to me the Emperor is in a ferment about some association between Arrakis and his mysterious prison planet. Now, I rushed the warning out to Rabban only because the courier had to leave on that highliner. You said there could be no delay.
Well and good.
But now I will have an explanation.
He babbles too much, Howard thought. He's not like Leto, who could tell me a thing with the lift of an eyebrow or the wave of a hand. Nor like the old Duke, who could express an entire sentence in the way he accented a single word. This is a clod. Destroying him will be a service to mankind.
You will not leave here until I've had a full and complete explanation, the Baron said.
You speak too casually of Seleucus Secundus, Hawat said.
It's a penal colony, the Baron said. The worst riffraff in the galaxy are sent to Seleucus Secundus. What else do we need to know?
That conditions on the prison planet are more oppressive than anywhere else, Hawat said. You hear that the mortality rate among new prisoners is higher than 60%. You hear that the Emperor practices every form of oppression there. You hear all this, and do not ask questions.
The Emperor doesn't permit the great houses to inspect his prison, the Baron growled.
But he hasn't seen into my dungeons either.
And curiosity about Seleucus Secundus is...
Hawat put a bony finger to his lips.
Discouraged.
So he's not proud of some of the things he must do there.
Hawat allowed the faintest of smiles to touch his dark lips. His eyes glinted in the glow-tube light as he stared at the Baron.
And you've never wondered where the Emperor gets his Sardaukar?
The Baron pursed his fat lips.
This gave his features the look of a pouting baby, and his voice carried a tone of petulance as he said,
Why, he recruits... That is to say, there are the levies, and he enlists from...
Fah, Howard snapped. The stories you hear about the exploits of the Sardaukar,
they're not rumors, are they?
Those are first-hand accounts from the limited number of survivors who fought against the Sardaukar, eh?
The Sardaukar are excellent fighting men, no doubt of it, the Baron said.
But I think my own legions...
A pack of holiday excursionists, by comparison, Hawat snarled.
You think I don't know why the Emperor turned against House Atreides?
This is not a realm open to your speculation, the Baron warned.
Is it possible that even he doesn't know what motivated the Emperor in this? Hawat asked himself.
Any area is open to my speculation if it does what you've hired me to do, Hawat said.
I am a Mentat. You do not withhold information or computation lines from a Mentat.
For a long minute, the Baron stared at him. Then,
say what you must say, Mentat.
The Padishah Emperor turned against House Atreides because the Duke's War Masters, Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho, had trained a fighting force. A small fighting force, to within a hair as good as the Sardaukar. Some of them were even better. And the Duke was in a position to enlarge his force, to make it every bit as strong as the Emperor's.
The Baron weighed this disclosure.
Then, what has Arrakis to do with this?
It provides a pool of recruits already conditioned to the bitterest survival training.
The Baron shook his head.
You cannot mean the Fremen.
I mean the Fremen.
Ha! Then why warn Rabban? There cannot be more than a handful of Fremen left after the Sardaukar pogrom and Rabban's oppression.
Hawat continued to stare at him silently.
Not more than a handful, the Baron repeated. Rabban killed
1,000 of them last year alone. Still, Hawat stared at him. And the year before, it was 9,000, the Baron said. And before they left, the Sardaukar must have accounted for at least 20,000.
What are Raban's troop losses for the past 2 years? Hawat asked.
The Baron rubbed his jowls.
Well, he has been recruiting rather heavily, to be sure. His agents make rather extravagant promises, and
shall we say 30,000 in round numbers? Hawat asked.
That would seem a little high, the Baron said.
Quite the contrary, Hawat said. I can read between the lines of Raban's reports as well as you can. And you certainly must have understood my reports from our agents.
Arrakis is a fierce planet, the Baron said. Storm losses can...
We both know the figure for storm accretion, Hawat said.
What if he has lost 30,000, the Baron demanded, and blood darkened his face.
By your own count, Hawat said, he killed 15,000 over 2 years while losing twice that number.
You say the Sardaukar accounted for another 20,000, possibly a few more.
And I've seen the transportation manifests for their return from Arrakis.
If they killed 20,000, they lost almost 5-for-1.
Why won't you face these figures, Baron, and understand what they mean?
The Baron spoke in a coldly measured cadence. This is your job, Mentat. What do they mean?
I gave you Duncan Idaho's head count on the CH he visited, Hawat said. It all fits. If they had just 250 such CH communities, their population would be about 5 million. My best estimate is that they had at least twice that many communities. You scatter your population on such a planet.
10 million.
The Baron's jowls quivered with amazement.
At least.
The Baron pursed his fat lips. The beady eyes stared without wavering at Hawat.
Is this true, Mentat computation? He wondered.
How could this be and no one suspect?
We haven't even cut heavily into their birth rate growth figure, Hawat said.
We've just weeded out some of their less successful specimens, leaving the strong to grow stronger. Just like on Seleucus Secundus.
Seleucus Secundus, the Baron barked. What has this to do with the Emperor's prison planet?
A man who survives Seleucus Secundus starts out being tougher than most others, Hawat said.
When you add the very best of military training...
Nonsense!
By your argument, I could recruit from among the Fremen after the way they've been oppressed by my nephew.
Hawat spoke in a mild voice. Don't you oppress any of your troops?
Well, I...
But oppression is a relative thing, Hawat said. Your fighting men are much better off than those around them, huh? They see unpleasant alternative to being soldiers of the Baron, eh?
The Baron fell silent, eyes unfocused.
The possibilities. Had Raban unwittingly given House Harkonnen its ultimate weapon? Presently he said, how could you be sure of the loyalty of such recruits?
I would take them in small groups. Not larger than platoon strength, Hawat said.
I'd remove them from their oppressive situation and isolate them with a training cadre of people who understood their background, preferably people who had preceded them from the same oppressive situation. Then I'd fill them with the mystique that their planet had really been a secret training ground to produce just such superior beings as themselves. And all the while...
I'd show them what such superior beings could earn. Rich living, beautiful women, fine mansions, whatever they desired. The Baron began to nod. The way the Sardaukar live at home. The recruits come to believe in time that such a place as Seleucus Secundus is justified because it produced them, the elite. The commonest Sardaukar trooper lives a life in many respects as exalted as that of any member of a great house. Such an idea, the Baron whispered.
You begin to share my suspicions, Hawat said.
Where did such a thing start? The Baron asked.
Ah, yes. Where did House Carino originate? Were there people on Seleucus Secundus before the Emperor sent his first contingents of prisoners there? Even the Duke Leto, a cousin on the distaff side, never knew for sure. Such questions are not encouraged. The Baron's eyes glazed with thought.
Yes, a very carefully kept secret. They'd use every device of... Besides, what's there to conceal? Hawat asked. That the Padishah Emperor has a prison planet? Everyone knows this.
That he has Count Fenring, the Baron blurted.
Hawat broke off, studied the Baron with a puzzled frown.
What of Count Fenring?
At my nephew's birthday several years ago, the Baron said, this imperial popinjay, Count Fenring, came as official observer and to conclude a business arrangement between the Emperor and myself.
So?
During one of our conversations, I believe I said something about making a prison planet of Arrakis.
Fenring, what did you say exactly? Hawat asked.
Exactly? That was quite a while ago, and my Lord Baron, if you wish to make the best use of my services, you must give me adequate information. Wasn't this conversation recorded?
The Baron's face darkened with anger.
You're as bad as Piter. I don't like these...
Piter is no longer with you, my lord, Hawat said.
As to that, whatever did happen to Piter?
He became too familiar, too demanding of me, the Baron said.
You assure me you don't waste a useful man, Hawat said. Will you waste me by threats and quibbling? We were discussing what you said to Count Fenring.
Slowly the Baron composed his features.
When the time comes, he thought, I'll remember his manner with me.
Yes, I will remember.
One moment, the Baron said, and he thought back to the meeting in his great hall. It helped to visualize the cone of silence in which they had stood.
I said something like this, the Baron said. The Emperor knows a certain amount of killing has always been an arm of business. I was referring to our workforce losses. Then I said something about considering another solution to the Arrakeen problem, and I said the Emperor's prison planet inspired me to emulate him.
Witchblood, Hawat snapped.
What did Fenring say?
That's when he began questioning me about you.
Hawat sat back, closed his eyes in thought.
So that's why they started looking into Arrakis, he said.
Well, the thing's done.
He opened his eyes. They must have spies all over Arrakis by now.
2 years!
But certainly my innocent suggestion that nothing is innocent in an emperor's eyes.
What were your instructions to Raban?
merely that he should teach Arrakis to fear us.
Hawat shook his head.
You now have two alternatives, Baron. You can kill off the natives, wipe them out entirely, or waste an entire workforce. Would you prefer to have the Emperor and those great houses he can still swing behind him come in here and perform a curetement, scrape out Giri Prime like a hollow gourd?
The Baron studied his mentat. Then he wouldn't dare.
Wouldn't he? The Baron's lips quivered. What is your alternative?
Abandon your dear nephew, Rabban.
The Baron broke off, stared at Hawat. Send him no more troops. No aid of any kind. Don't answer his messages other than to say you've heard of the terrible way he's handled things on Arrakis, and you intend to take corrective measures as soon as you're able. I'll arrange to have some of your messages intercepted by Imperial spies.
But what of the spice? The revenues that
demand your baronial profits, but be careful how you make your demands. Require fixed sums of Rabban. The Baron turned his hands, palms up. But how can I be certain that my weasel nephew isn't...
We still have our spies on Arrakis. Tell Rabban he either meets the spice quotas you set him or he'll be replaced.
I know my nephew, the Baron said. This would only make him oppress the population even more.
Of course he will, Hawat snapped. You don't want that stopped now. You merely want your own hands clean.
Let Rabban make your Seleucus Secundus for you. There's no need even to send him any prisoners. He has all the population required. If Rabban is driving his people to meet your spice quotas, then the Emperor need suspect no other motive. That's reason enough for putting the planet on the rack. And you, Baron, will not show by word or action that there's any other reason for this. The Baron could not keep the sly tone of admiration out of his voice.
Ah, Hawat, you are a devious one.
Now, how do we move into Arrakis and make use of what Rabban prepares?
That's the simplest thing of all, Baron. If you set each year's quota a bit higher than the one before, matters will soon reach a head there. Production will drop off. You can remove Rabban and take over yourself to correct the mess.
It fits, the Baron said. But I can feel myself tiring of all this. I'm preparing another to take over Arrakis for me.
Hawat studied the fat, round face across from him. Slowly the old soldier spy began to nod his head.
Feyd Rautha, he said. So that's the reason for the oppression now.
You're very devious yourself, Baron.
Perhaps we can incorporate these two schemes.
Yes. Your Feyd Rautha can go to Arrakis as their savior. He can win the populace.
Yes.
The Baron smiled, and behind his smile he asked himself,
Now, how does this fit in with Hawat's personal scheming?
And Hawat, seeing that he was dismissed, arose and left the red-walled room. As he walked, he could not put down the disturbing unknowns that cropped into every computation about Arrakis.
This new religious leader that Gurney Halleck hinted at from his hiding place among the smugglers, this Muad'Dib.
Perhaps I should not have told the Baron to let this religion flourish where it will, even among the folk of Pan and Graben, he told himself. But it's well known that repression makes a religion flourish. And he thought about Halleck's reports on Fremen battle tactics. The tactics smacked of Halleck himself, and Idaho, and even of Hawat. Did Idaho survive? He asked himself. But this was a futile question. He did not yet ask himself if it was possible that Paul had survived. He knew the Baron was convinced that all Atreides were dead. The Bene Gesserit witch had been his weapon, the Baron admitted, and that could only mean an end to all, even to the woman's own son. What a poisonous hate she must have had for the Atreides, he thought. Something like the hate I hold for this Baron. Will my blow be as final and complete as hers? There is in all things a pattern that is part of our universe. It has symmetry, elegance, and grace. Those qualities you find always in that which the true artist captures. You can find it in the turning of the seasons, in the way sand trails along a ridge, in the branch clusters of the creosote bush or the pattern of its leaves. We try to copy these patterns in our lives and our society, seeking the rhythms, the dances, the forms that comfort. Yet it is possible to see peril in the finding of ultimate perfection. It is clear that the ultimate pattern contains its own fixity. In such perfection, all things move toward death. From the Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Paul Muad'Dib remembered that there had been a meal heavy with spice essence. He clung to this memory because it was an anchor point, and he could tell himself from this vantage that his immediate experience must be a dream. I am a theater of processes, he told himself. I am a prey to the imperfect vision, to the race consciousness and its terrible purpose. Yet he could not escape the fear that he had somehow overrun himself, lost his position in time, so that past and future and present mingled without distinction. It was a kind of visual fatigue, and it came, he knew, from the constant necessity of holding the prescient future as a kind of memory, that was in itself a thing intrinsically of the past. Cheney prepared the meal for me, he told himself. Yet Cheney was deep in the south, in the cold country where the sun was hot, secreted in one of the new Siech strongholds, safe with their son, Leto II. Or was that a thing yet to happen? No, he reassured himself, for Aaliyah the Strange One, his sister, had gone there with his mother and with Cheney, a 20-thumper trip into the south, riding a reverend mother's palanquin fixed to the back of a wild maker. He shied away from thought of riding the giant worms, asking himself, or is Aaliyah yet to be born? I was on Razia, Paul recalled. We went raiding to recover the water of our dead in Arakeen, and I found the remains of my father in the funeral pyre. I enshrined the skull of my father in a Fremen rock mound overlooking Harg Pass. Or was that a thing yet to be? My wounds are real, Paul told himself. My scars are real. The shrine of my father's skull is real. Still in the dreamlike state, Paul remembered that Hera, Jameis's wife, had intruded on him once to say there'd been a fight in the CH corridor. That had been the interim CH before the women and children had been sent into the deep south. Hera had stood there in the entrance to the inner chamber, the black wings of her hair tied back by water rings on a chain. She had held aside the chamber's hangings and told him that Cheney had just killed someone. This happened, Paul told himself. This was real, not born out of its time and subject to change.
Paul remembered he had rushed out to find Chaney standing beneath the yellow globes of the corridor, clad in a brilliant blue wraparound robe with hood thrown back, a flush of exertion on her elfin features. She had been sheathing her kris knife. A huddled group had been hurrying away down the corridor with a burden. And Paul remembered telling himself, "You always know when they're carrying a body." Chaney's water rings, worn openly in CH on a cord around her neck, tinkled as she turned toward him. "Chaney, what is this?" he asked. "I dispatched one who came to challenge you in single combat, Usul." "You killed him?" "Yes. But perhaps I should have left him for Hera." And Paul recalled how the faces of the people around them had showed appreciation for these words. Even Hera had laughed. "But he came to challenge me." "You trained me yourself in the weirding way, Usul."
"Certainly. But you shouldn't..."
"I was born in the desert, Usul. I know how to use a kris knife." He suppressed his anger, tried to talk reasonably. "This may all be true, Chaney, but I am no longer a child hunting scorpions in the CH by the light of a hand globe, Usul. I do not play games." Paul glared at her, caught by the odd ferocity beneath her casual attitude. "He was not worthy, Usul," Chaney said. "I'd not disturb your meditations with the likes of him." She moved closer, looking at him out of the corners of her eyes, dropping her voice so that only he might hear. "And, beloved, when it's learned that a challenger may face me and be brought to shameful death by Muad'Dib's woman, there'll be fewer challengers." Yes, Paul told himself, that had certainly happened. It was true past. And the number of challengers testing the new blade of Muad'Dib did drop dramatically. Somewhere, in a world not of the dream, there was a hint of motion, the cry of a nightbird. "I dream," Paul reassured himself. "It's the spice meal." Still, there was about him a feeling of abandonment. He wondered if it might be possible that his Ru spirit had slipped over somehow into the world where the Fremen believed he had his true existence. Into the Alam al-Mithal, the world of similitudes, that metaphysical realm where all physical limitations were removed. And he knew fear at the thought of such a place, because removal of all limitations meant removal of all points of reference. In the landscape of a myth, he could not orient himself and say, "I am I because I am here." His mother had said once, "The people are divided, some of them, in how they think of you." "I must be waking from the dream," Paul told himself. For this had happened. These words from his mother, the Lady Jessica, who was now a reverend mother of the Fremen, these words had passed through reality. Jessica was fearful of the religious relationship between himself and the Fremen, Paul knew. She didn't like the fact that people of both CH and Graben referred to Muad'Dib as him. And she went questioning among the tribes, sending out her Sayyidina spies, collecting their answers and brooding on them. She had quoted a Bene Gesserit proverb to him, "When religion and politics travel in the same cart, the riders believe nothing can stand in their way. Their movement becomes headlong, faster and faster and faster. They put aside all thought of obstacles and forget that a precipice does not show itself to the man in a bland rush until it's too late." Paul recalled that he had sat there in his mother's quarters, in the inner chamber shrouded by dark hangings with their surfaces covered by woven patterns out of Fremen mythology. He had sat there, hearing her out, noting the way she was always observing, even when her eyes were lowered. Her oval face had new lines in it at the corners of the mouth, but the hair was still like polished bronze. The wide-set green eyes, though, hid beneath their overcasting of spice-imbued blue. The Fremen have a simple, practical religion, he said. Nothing about religion is simple, she warned. But Paul, seeing the clouded future that still hung over them, found himself swayed by anger. He could only say, religion unifies our forces. It's our mystique. You deliberately cultivate this air, this bravura, she charged. You never cease indoctrinating. Thus you yourself taught me, he said. But she had been full of contentions and arguments that day. It had been the day of the circumcision ceremony for little Leto. Paul had understood some of the reasons for her upset. She had never accepted his liaison, the marriage of youth with Chaney. But Chaney had produced an Atreides son, and Jessica had found herself unable to reject the child with the mother. Jessica had stirred finely under his stare, said, "You think me an unnatural mother?" "Of course not. I see the way you watch me when I'm with your sister. You don't understand about your sister." "I know why Aaliyah is different," he said. "She was unborn, part of you, when you changed the water of life. You know nothing of it." And Paul, suddenly unable to express the knowledge gained out of its time, said only, "I don't think you unnatural." She saw his distress, said, "There is a thing, son." "Yes?" "I do love your Chaney. I accept her." This was real, Paul told himself. This wasn't the imperfect vision to be changed by the twistings out of time's own birth. The reassurance gave him a new hold on his world. Bits of solid reality began to dip through the dream state into his awareness. He knew suddenly that he was in a hereg, a desert camp. Chaney had planted their still tent on flower sand for its softness. That could only mean Chaney was nearby. Chaney. His soul, Chaney, his Sihaya, sweet as the desert spring, Chaney up from the palmeries of the deep south. Now he remembered her singing a sand shanty to him in the time for sleep. "O my soul, have no taste for paradise this night, and I swear by Shai-Hulud you will go there, obedient to my love." And she had sung the walking song lovers shared on the sand, its rhythm like the drag of the dunes against the feet. "Tell me of thine eyes, and I will tell thee of thy heart. Tell me of thy feet, and I will tell thee of thy hands. Tell me of thy sleeping, and I will tell thee of thy waking. Tell me of thy desires, and I will tell thee of thy need." He had heard someone strumming a balisette in another tent, and he'd thought then of Gurney Halleck. Reminded by the familiar instrument, he had thought of Gurney, whose face he had seen in a smuggler band, but who had not seen him, could not see him or know of him, lest that inadvertently lead the Harkonnens to the son of the duke they had killed. But the style of the player in the night, the distinctiveness of the fingers on the balisette's strings, brought the real musician back to Paul's memory. It had been Chat the Leaper, captain of the Fedaiken, leader of the death commandos who guarded Muad'Dib. "We are in the desert," Paul remembered. "We are in the central Urg beyond the Harkonnen patrols. I am here to walk the sand, to lure a maker and mount him by my own cunning that I may be a Fremen entire." He felt now the Mala pistol at his belt, the kris knife. He felt the silence surrounding him. It was that special pre-morning silence when the night birds had gone and the day creatures had not yet signaled their alertness to their enemy, the sun.
You must ride the sand in the light of day that Shai-Hulud shall see, and know you have no fear, Stilgar had said. Thus we turn our time around and set ourselves to sleep this night. Quietly, Paul sat up, feeling the looseness of a slacked stillsuit around his body, the shadowed still tent beyond. So softly he moved, yet Chaney heard him. She spoke from the tent's gloom, another shadow there. It's not yet full light, beloved. Siaya, he said, speaking with half a laugh in his voice. You call me your desert spring, she said, but this day I'm thy goad. I am the Sayyidina who watches that the rites be obeyed. He began tightening his stillsuit. You told me once the words of the Kitab al-Ibar, he said. You told me, woman is thy field. Go then to thy field and till it. I am the mother of thy firstborn, she agreed. He saw her in the grayness matching him, movement for movement, securing her stillsuit for the open desert. You should get all the rest you can, she said. He recognized her love for him speaking then and chided her gently. The Sayyidina of the Watch does not caution or warn the candidate. She slid across to his side, touched his cheek with her palm. Today, I am both the Watcher and the Woman. You should have left this duty to another, he said. Waiting is bad enough at best, she said. I'd sooner be at thy side. He kissed her palm before securing the face flap of his suit, then turned and cracked the seal of the tent. The air that came into them held the chill, not quite dryness that would precipitate trace dew in the dawn. With it came the smell of a pre-spice mass, the mass they had detected off to the northeast, and that told them there would be a maker nearby. Paul crawled through the sphincter opening, stood on the sand, and stretched the sleep from his muscles. A faint green-pearl luminescence etched the eastern horizon. The tents of his troop were small, false dunes around him in the gloom. He saw movement off to the left. The guard, and knew they had seen him. They knew the peril he faced this day. Each Fremen had faced it. They gave him this last few moments of isolation now that he might prepare himself. It must be done today, he told himself. He thought of the power he wielded in the face of the pogrom. The old men who sent their sons to him to be trained in the weirding way of battle. The old men who listened to him now in council and followed his plans. The men who returned to pay him that highest Fremen compliment. Your plan worked, Muad'Dib. Yet the meanest and smallest of the Fremen warriors could do a thing that he had never done. And Paul knew his leadership suffered from the omnipresent knowledge of this difference between them. He had not ridden the Maker. Oh, he'd gone up with the others for training trips and raids, but he had not made his own voyage. Until he did, his world was bounded by the abilities of others. No true Fremen could permit this. Until he did this thing himself, even the great Southlands, the area some 20 thumpers beyond the Urg, were denied him unless he ordered a palanquin and rode like a reverend mother or one of the sick and wounded. Memory returned to him of his wrestling with his inner awareness during the night. He saw a strange parallel here. If he mastered the Maker, his rule was strengthened. If he mastered the inward eye, this carried its own measure of command. But beyond them both lay the clouded area, the great unrest where all the universe seemed embroiled. The differences in the ways he comprehended the universe haunted him. Accuracy matched with inaccuracy. He saw it in situ. Yet when it was born, when it came into the pressures of reality, the now had its own life and grew with its own subtle differences. Terrible purpose remained. Race consciousness remained. And over all loomed the jihad, bloody and wild. Cheney joined him outside the tent, hugging her elbows, looking up at him from the corners of her eyes the way she did when she studied his mood.
"Tell me again about the waters of thy birth world, Usul," she said.
He saw that she was trying to distract him, ease his mind of tensions before the deadly test. It was growing lighter, and he noted that some of his fedaikin were already striking their tents.
"I'd rather you told me about the CH and about our son," he said.
"Does our Leto yet hold my mother in his palm?"
"It's Aliyah he holds as well," she said. "And he grows rapidly. He'll be a big man."
"What's it like in the South?" he asked.
"When you ride the Maker, you'll see for yourself," she said.
"But I wish to see it first through your eyes."
"It's powerfully lonely," she said.
He touched the Najoni scarf at her forehead where it protruded from her stillsuit cap.
"Why will you not talk about the CH?
"I have talked about it. The CH is a lonely place without our men. It's a place of work. We labor in the factories and the potting rooms. There are weapons to be made, poles to plant that we may forecast the weather, spice to collect for the bribes. There are dunes to be planted to make them grow and to anchor them. There are fabrics and rugs to make, fuel cells to charge. There are children to train, that the tribe's strength may never be lost."
"Is nothing, then, pleasant in the CH?" he asked.
"The children are pleasant. We observe the rites. We have sufficient food. Sometimes one of us may come north to be with her man. Life must go on."
"My sister, Aliyah, is she accepted yet by the people?"
Cheney turned toward him in the growing dawn light. Her eyes bored into him.
"It's a thing to be discussed another time, beloved. Let us discuss it now."
"You should conserve your energies for the test," she said. He saw that he had touched something sensitive, hearing the withdrawal in her voice.
"The unknown brings its own worries," he said.
Presently she nodded, said, "There is yet misunderstanding because of Aliyah's strangeness. The women are fearful because a child, little more than an infant, talks of things that only an adult should know. They do not understand the change in the womb that made Aliyah different."
"There is trouble?" he asked,
and he thought, "I've seen visions of trouble over Aliyah." Cheney looked toward the growing line of the sunrise.
"Some of the women banded to appeal to their reverend mother. They demanded she exorcise the demon in her daughter. They quoted the scripture, 'Suffer not a witch to live among us.'"
"And what did my mother say to them?"
"She recited the law and sent the women away abashed. She said, 'If Aliyah incites trouble, it is the fault of authority for not foreseeing and preventing the trouble.' And she tried to explain how the change had worked on Aliyah in the womb. But the women were angry because they had been embarrassed. They went away muttering."
"There will be trouble because of Aliyah," he thought.
A crystal blowing of sand touched the exposed portions of his face, bringing the scent of the pre-spice mass.
"El Sayal, the rain of sand that brings the morning," he said.
He looked out across the gray light of the desert landscape,
the landscape beyond pity, the sand that was form absorbed in itself. Dry lightning streaked a dark corner to the south, sign that a storm had built up its static charge there. The roll of thunder boomed long after. "The voice that beautifies the land," Cheney said. More of his men were stirring out of their tents. Guards were coming in from the rims. Everything around him moved smoothly in the ancient routine that required no orders. "Give as few orders as possible," his father had told him. "Once. Long ago. Once you've given orders on a subject, you must always give orders on that subject." The Fremen knew this rule instinctively. The troop's watermaster began the morning shanty, adding to it now the call for the right to initiate a sand rider. "The world is a carcass," the man chanted, his voice wailing across the dunes. "Who can turn away the angel of death? What Shai-Hulud has decreed must be." Paul listened, recognizing that these were the words that also began the death chant of his Fedaiken, the words the death commandos recited as they hurled themselves into battle. This book is continued on Disc 17.